and he tries to do well, but it's the drink. He just doesn't know how to control it. Her face was sad and her voice trembled as she put fresh ice and scotch in our glasses. Her husband was away on a long trip, and she was finding it hard to manage her loneliness. The next few weeks brought a change in our relationship, which I never expected. We reversed roles. Mother began to lean on me, to look to me for support and wisdom, and I automatically, without thinking about it, started to perform as the shrewd authority, the judicious one, the mother. Guy was disconcerted by the new positions in the family. He became rigidly courteous, smiled less, and assumed a sober stateliness which sat awkwardly on the shoulders of a teenage boy. Vus called from Cairo to say that our tickets were waiting at a local travel agency, and it was impossible to hide my relief. When I told Mother that we would be leaving soon, she came out of her doldrums for a few hours of celebration. She was thankful, she said, not only for my support, but that she had raised a woman who could stand up in a crisis. We left San Francisco with her assurance that she would work out the difficulties in her own life, and we were not to worry. Her last bidding was not easily carried out. I sat through the entire journey, from San Francisco to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to London, London to Rome, with the concern for my mother riding in my lap. Only when we left Rome's airport did I start to think about Egypt, about Vus, and the life my son and I were just about to begin. Our plane landed at Cairo on a clear afternoon, and just beyond the windows, the Sahara was a rippling beige sea which had no shore. Guy and I went through customs, each peering through frosted glass for a sight of Vus. We had lugged our baggage through a group of laughing porters and janitors when two black men in neat Western suits approached. "Sister Maya? Sister Make?" I nodded. "Welcome to Cairo. And Guy? Welcome." We shook hands and they mentioned their multisyllabic names. Vus was in a meeting with a high official and would join us as soon as possible. He had asked them to pick us up and bring us to his office. They helped us into a ramshackle Mercedes-Benz, as if they were placing royalty into a state carriage. When we entered the center of Cairo, the avenues burst wide open with such a force of color, of people, action, and smells that I was stripped of my cool composure. I touched the man in the front passenger seat and shouted at him, "What's going on? Is today a holiday?" He looked out the open windows and turned back to me, shaking his head. "The crowd? Do you mean the crowd?" I nodded. He said, "No, this is just everyday Cairo." Guy was so happy he laughed aloud. I looked at the scene and wondered how we were going to enjoy living in a year-long Mardi Gras. Our escorts parked the car, then led us through a carefully tended front garden and into a whitewashed office building. They placed our luggage by the door in the lobby. Vus entered through the open doors. He shouted when he saw us and came rushing to hold me and Guy in his arms. "Come, let us go home. We live across the street." Vus led us up the stairs of a large marble-fronted building. At the end of the corridor, he unlocked a carved door, and we entered a luxurious living room. A gold and red-striped satin sofa was the first object which caught and held my attention. A muted tapestry hung on the wall above another rich-looking sofa. In the middle of the room, a low table of exquisite parquetry rested on an antique oriental rug. Vus took my elbow and directed me into the next room, where Louis XVI brocaded sofa and chairs rested on another rich rug. I grinned because I didn't know what else to do. When we reached the empty kitchen, a little sense returned to me. A soot-encrusted lamp sat on a ledge with stacked plates, a pile of cheap cutlery, and thick glasses. Voos coughed, embarrassed. "They use that," indicating the lamp, "to cook on. It is called a sterno stove. I didn't get around to fixing up the kitchen yet. Anyway, regular stoves are very, very expensive. I thought I'd wait until you arrived." "You mean we own all that crap?" I must have shouted because Guy, who was crowded into the small room with us, frowned at me, and Voos gave me a haughty, angry look. "I have tried to make a beautiful house for you, even to the point of ignoring my own work. Yes, I have postponed important PAC affairs to decorate this apartment, and you call it crap?" He turned and walked through the door. Guy shook his head, disgusted with my lack of gratitude and grace, and followed Voos out of the kitchen. A profound sense of worthlessness had made me pull away from owning good things, expensive furniture, rare rugs. That was exactly how white folks wanted me to feel. I was black, so obviously I didn't deserve to have armoires shiny with good French veneer or tapestries where mounted warriors waged their ancient battles in silk thread. No, I decided to crush that feeling of unworthiness. I heard Voos and Guy's voices from the balcony, so I went to join them with a smile warm enough to melt the snows on Mount Everest. I said, "This is the most gorgeous house I've ever seen." Voos nodded and smiled at me, as if I were a recalcitrant child who had recovered her good manners following a foolish tantrum. Guy grinned. He had known his mother would come through. The first weeks in Cairo were occupied with introductions to freedom fighters from Uganda, Kenya, Tanganyika, North and South Rhodesia, Basutoland, and Swaziland. Diplomats from already independent African countries dropped by our apartment to meet Voos Make's American wife, who was trying to be all things to everybody. I had hired Umanadia, a short, stocky older woman from the Sudan, as cook housekeeper, after Voos said my reluctance to have a servant in the house was not proof of a democratic spirit, but rather of a bourgeois snobism, which kept a good job from a needy worker. Guy was enrolled in the American College at Mahdi and was picked up daily in a bus for the 15-mile ride out of Cairo to his school. There was an Afro-Asian Solidarity Conference in downtown Cairo, and Voos thought I might like to attend. The sight of the huge auditorium made me catch my breath. Long tables banked at an easy incline held headsets and microphones, and men of every color, wearing various national outfits, wandered the aisles, conversing loudly in many languages strange to my ear. "I want to introduce you to your fellow countrymen." I looked around to see a thin young man dressed in a well-cut suit smiling at me. Voos said, "This is David Du Bois. He is a journalist in Cairo and my very good friend. David, meet my wife, Maya." "Hello, Maya Angelou Make. I've heard about you. All Egypt will be happy to welcome you, and they say you can sing, too." The voice of an adult American black man has undeniable textures. I had forgotten how much I love those sweet cadences. I said, "I surely want to thank you, and I'm glad to be here." We smiled at each other and embraced. Maybe he had missed hearing a black American woman's voice. Umanadia came to the balcony on a lovely summer afternoon. "Madam," I had arisen from a nap in the cool bedroom. I felt refreshed and indulgent. "Yes, Umanadia." She could not have the rest of the day off, if that was what she wanted. I needed a little more pampering. She said, "Madam, I stopped the rug man again. You were sleeping." I asked, "What rug man?" "I was awake, but slow." She said, "The man collecting for the rugs. He hasn't been paid for 2 months. And the 2 furniture collectors." I asked, "Umanadia, how much do we owe?" She made her fingers an abacus. We had only paid a tenth of the price on the rugs. We owed over half the cost of the bedroom furniture. The two living rooms and the dining room set were way overdue for payment, and our rent was 2 months in arrears. I thanked her and told her to take the rest of the afternoon off. The specter of the New York City deputy sheriff stood in the doorway, hid just behind the heavy drapes, waited nearly visible in my well-tended flower garden. I had to get a job. David answered his telephone, and when I said I had an emergency, he agreed to meet me at a tea room in downtown Cairo. The restaurant was luminous with crystal chandeliers. He had chosen a table in the center of the glitter. He asked, "What is the emergency? Does it have to do with Vus?" He looked at me directly, and I thought, "Doesn't everything have to do with Vus?" I said, "I'm getting a little bored sitting at home. I've worked all my life, so really I thought maybe you might know how I could get a job, just to have something to do." He relaxed and grinned. "You want a job? Nice women don't work in Cairo. I thought you knew that." I said, "David, I'm broke. I don't have enough money to go back home, and I can't stay here unless I get a job." The smile faded from his face, and he nodded. "Okay. Okay, I figured it was something like that. Maybe I can get something for you. I'll do what I can. What about Vus? Will he let you work?" I said, "If I can get a job, I'll handle the rest of it." 2 days later, David took me to meet Zain Nagati, president of the Middle East Feature News Agency. He had started a magazine called The Arab Observer. David Du Bois said I was an experienced journalist, wife of a freedom fighter, and an expert administrator. Would I be interested in the job of associate editor? If so, I should realize that since I was neither Egyptian, Arabic, nor Muslim, and since I would be the only woman working in the office, things would not be easy. He mentioned a salary that sounded like pots of gold to my ears, and standing, he reached for my hand. "Very good, Mrs. Make. You'll begin on Monday. I'll be there to introduce you, and David Du Bois can show you around. Salam." He picked up his briefcase, inclined his head to me, shook hands with David, and left the room. I wanted to speak, but I felt I had fallen into a deep trench with steep, muddy sides. When I regained a degree of composure, David was talking. He said, "You won't find it that hard. I'll help. Call me at any time. You've done reporting, and you've run offices. Anyway, you wanted a job." Vus returned on Sunday morning, rested and handsome. He was the only person I ever knew who could finish a 10-hour plane trip looking as fresh as new money. We spent a lovely hour in the bedroom reacquainting our bodies, and then I brought hot tea and cake to the living room. Vus joined me in his robe and slippers. I began cautiously. I said, "I saw David Du Bois. We went to tea." He said, "Oh, great. How is he?" I said, "I asked him to help me find a job." He began to laugh. At first, a few chuckles, but they increased to a hearty guffaw. Then he lost his breath again. When he calmed down, his first words were, "You black women, who knows what to do with you? As my wife and as a foreigner as well, you would never find a job." I said, "Vus, the rent is past due. The collectors have been here for payment on the furniture and the rugs. Guy's school has sent 2 notes home. I have to go to work." He said, "But I will see that everyone is paid. I always do, don't I?" I wouldn't answer, and I wouldn't remind him of the New York eviction. I said, "Vus, I have a job. Associate editor of the Arab Observer. I start tomorrow." I watched the disbelief on his face turn to anger, then to rage. "You took a job without consulting me? Are you a man?" He stood and began to pace over the expensive rug. His tirade carried him from the sofa to the entry, over to the large chair, and back to stand in front of me. His vilification included my insolence, independence, lack of respect, arrogance, ignorance, defiance, callousness, cheekiness, and lack of breeding. I sat watching him, listening and thinking. He was right. Somewhere in his swarm of words, he had my apt description. I also understood that maybe I had gone too far. Even an American black man would have found such a headstrong wife unsuitable. And how much more an African husband, steeped in a tradition of at least the appearance of male authority. I realized that I had handled the thing badly. I should have been more delicate. With the awareness of my unfortunate mismanagement came the shocking knowledge that I was no longer in love. He said, "You must call David and explain that you acted as an American woman, but that I have returned home and reminded you that now you are an African wife." I knew that neither threats nor inducements would cause me to give up the job. I made my voice silken soft. I said, "I have given my word." He tried to build up to the earlier anger, but was too tired to do so. He went back to the bedroom and reappeared dressed. He walked past me and out of the house, slamming the door. I stayed in the pretty living room thinking. The doorbell rang. I decided Vuce had stalked out, leaving his keys. I opened the door. David Du Bois stood smiling at me in the dim light. He said, "Girl, I thought you might be getting nervous about tomorrow, so I came around to tell you everything is going to be all right." We sat in the living room talking lightly about journalism and expectations. Vuce walked in on our inane chatter. When he saw David, his face lightened, his heavy cheeks lifted, and he smiled delightedly. David said, "Vuce, you must be very proud of your wife. I mean, about her job." Vuce cooled and drew himself inward. David looked at me, caught the misery, which I didn't try to hide, and turned back to Vuce. He said, "When you were away, she telephoned me. I took her out to tea, and she said you were working so hard, stretching yourself so thin, that she was beginning to worry about your health. She said that as your wife, she had to carry some of the load." Vuce's body began to relax. With words, David was stroking away his hostility. He said, "She said that most African men in your position would never allow their wives to work, but that you were a true revolutionary, and that the success of the African conflict was your goal, and that you meant to reach it by any means necessary." Vuce nodded. "True, true." David was persuasive, convincing, and a liar. He was also my supportive, fast-thinking, inventive brother. I was surprised to find when Vuce and I went to bed that being in the arms of a stranger in no way lessened my physical pleasure. I stayed at the Arab Observer for over a year, and gradually my ignorance receded. I learned from Abdul Hassan how to write an opinionated article with such subtlety that the reader would think the opinion his own. Vuce supplied me with particulars on the politically fluid, newly independent African states. Although the romance in our marriage had evaporated, I still admired and appreciated him. I even loved him. I simply was not in love with him. There was ample evidence that he had other romantic interests anyway. Often he returned home very late, reeking of perfume, heavy-lidded, and offering no explanation. On a few evenings, he didn't return at all. I said nothing. I had my work, my house, and had made two friends. A.B. Williamson, the round, pretty wife of the Liberian chargé d'affaires, and Kebidech Irdachu, wife of the Ethiopian embassy's first secretary. On the surface, we seemed to have nothing in common, save our gender and our blackness. Kebidech was thin, small, and married to a son of the royal Selassie house. She was as beautiful as antique gold and as reserved as a vault. A.B., friends called her Banti, had been raised in the underdeveloped Grand Bassa region of Liberia. Her pert looks and witty good humor won her friends and marriage to a bright young lawyer, Joe Williamson, whose career was just beginning to rise. The couple lived in the ambassador's residence with their own three children, Bonte's younger sister, the teenage daughter of a friend, two Liberian maids, and Nanny, an Egyptian laundryman, a doorman, and a cook. Bonte gave a hilarious party to which only women were invited. The occasion was a celebration of the birthday of a great Liberian female doctor. Elaborate food and a variety of drinks were served by uniformed attendants. The living room was decorated as if for a supreme embassy function, and a trio of musicians played familiar melodies. Wives and secretaries from the African embassies and a sprinkling of Egyptian women and I felt deliciously important. We ate, talked, drank, and half the invitees finally danced, moving individually across Bonte's polished hardwood floor. Each woman observed the steps of her own country. The party was nearing its end when a young woman took the floor. She wore West African national dress. She had wide shoulders, large erect breasts, billowing hips, and the waist of a child. All the dancers backed away and found seats as the beautiful woman moved to the music. She swiveled and flourished, jostled and vibrated, accompanied by the audience's encouragement and laughter. "Swing it, girl, swing it! Show that thing, child, show it!" The viewer's delight reminded me of the pleasure old black American women found in younger women's sexiness. When the music and the dancing were finished, I joined the women who crowded around the dancer, patting, stroking her, and laughing. "I am from northern Nigeria." Her voice was soft, and she kept her eyes lowered, respecting the age and the positions of the older women. She said, "I am an unmarried girl with a good dowry. I am here to stay with Egyptian friends and study Arabic." Her name was Medina, and she was obviously looking for a husband. We complimented her on her beauty and welcomed her to Cairo, and I secretly wished her luck. 1 week later, Vus returned from Addis Ababa. He asked what had happened in his absence. I reported on my work. I also told him about the women's party and Medina. He accepted my news and told me dryly of his trip. The once exotic names no longer titillated me, and Vus had long since stopped trying to enchant me with tales of his perilous exploits. We returned to the sequence of our lives. Work occupied our days, and parsimonious lovemaking ended some stolid nights. The news spread in the African diplomatic corps that Medina was a slut, a hussy, a whore, a home-breaking harlot. The rumor was hot oil poured into the ears of the African women who had admired her. She had sought appointments with four ambassadors. Three had reported to their wives that the pretty woman offered them her favors in return for money. 2 months passed, and for the African community, Medina disappeared, lost her name, had no presence. Then one evening, an Egyptian woman, close acquaintance of the African women, gave a party. Vus and I arrived late. When we entered the first room, the informal lounge, Bonte and Kebi and seven women already sat on the sofas, their multicolored dresses radiant against their dark brown skin. They greeted Vus, who responded, and continued into the salon, where more guests stood talking. I stopped to exchange regards with my friends and the other ladies I had come to know and to like. Our small talk was suddenly pierced by, "Good evening, Mrs. Mackay." The sound was disquietingly familiar. I looked up and saw Medina in the arched doorway leading to a hall passage. She was standing by a record player. I nodded to her, and she lifted the machine's arm, stopping the music. She said, "Mrs. Mackay, Mr. Mackay has been trying to reach me all day long. He called all over Cairo, trying to get my number." Her words, voice, and intent were pitiless, and for seconds my heart opposed its natural function. She poked her voice easily through my entire body. She continued, "When he finally reached me, he said he had to talk to me, to see me about something very important." As she glanced at the seated women, I gritted my teeth and held on to the sternness of my long-dead grandmother. She said, "I refused to let him come to my apartment. Then he said it had to do with you, that you needed someone to help you at your office. I have been looking for a job, you know." No one moved. I raked through my mind, gathering every shred of skill, art, and craftiness, and stepped toward her. "Medina?" I held my voice soft and haughty. She looked up into my face as I approached. She said, "Yes, I am Medina, Mrs. Mackey." "And were you willing to work for me at a very high salary, with an allowance for rent and possibly your own car? Were you willing?" Deceit left her face, and suddenly she became a young girl who could have been my baby sister. Her defenses were down. She was vulnerable, and I thrust at her with all my will. I said, "Unfortunately, the job has been filled. But if it had not, dear Medina," I was still speaking low, "you would never do. You are ignorant, and you are a tramp." I gave her a filthy smile and walked past her into the salon. Luckily, a few chairs were lined against a rear wall. I went directly to a seat. Bante and Kebby rushed in and took seats on either side of me. They both murmured consolation. "You are wonderful, sister. Wonderful." At last I smiled and rose. Voos was standing alone near a distant window. He said, "Ah, my dear, nice party, isn't it?" I asked, "Voos, who is that girl playing records over there?" He turned and looked straight at Medina, whose profile was distinct against the white wall. He shook his head and said, "I don't know." I said, "Voos, you know her. Don't lie. At least don't lie." He twisted toward me, sudden recognition smoothing the planes of his face. He said, "Oh, say, is that Medina you were telling me about?" I wanted to slap him until he snapped and split open like popcorn. The silent ride home seemed endless. When we were at last in the apartment, I checked Guy's room and found him asleep. That part of my life was comfortably accounted for. Now all I had to do was face my lover and one-time love, whom I heard dragging furniture around in the living room. I went into our bedroom and stood in the dark, wondering how to begin. "Maya, Maya, don't go to bed yet." I walked out and down the hall. The big man sat composed and had arranged a chair so that I would sit and face him. He said, "Sit down, Maya. I want to talk to you about Medina. Medina and all the others." I sat facing him, our knees touching. He said, "A man requires a certain amount of sexual gratification, much more than a woman needs, wants, or understands." I said, "That's a lie, Voos. You're not a woman. How do you know what I need?" He said, "I do not choose to argue a point which cannot be proved, but which is tacitly agreed upon. I will continue. To an African man, the act of sex is only important as long as it lasts. It is not the factor which holds a family together. It pleases and relieves tension so that one can get on about the business of living." I asked with sarcastic sweetness, "And what about the African women? Don't they want pleasure and release?" He frowned, offended. "Haven't I always satisfied you?" The conversation was getting away from me. I said, "I don't love you anymore, Voos." It was the truth, but I used it not for declaration, as much as to startle him and take back a little advantage. He stayed at ease. "I know that, my dear. I've known it for a long time. Nor am I any longer in romantic love with you. However, we respect and admire each other. We have the asset of mutual goals, the struggle for freedom, loyalty to Mother Africa." He paused for a second, then went on in a softer voice, "And Guy's future as an African man." I asked, "What about Medina? Tell me about her. Tell me why you put my name into your mouth when all you wanted was to get her in your bed. He said, I apologize to you for that, sincerely. His quick mind served him quickly. He said, although I did hear you say you wish there was another black woman in your office, there have always been for me periods and arguments when my thoughts swirl around in semi-solid circles, leaving no protruding phrase for my mind to grab. I am rendered mute until the eddying jumble slows down, and I am able to pick out enough words to form the first sentence. The moment had come. I said, I'm leaving you, Vus. I'm not sure when or where I'm going, but I'm leaving you. His face didn't change from the placid sheet of control when I got up and went to bed. Bonte's telephone call at my office came unexpectedly. I had gone to her house early the morning following the Medina incident and told her of my plans to leave Vus. Sister, I heard her say on the telephone, Joe and I want you to come to us this evening after dinner, 9 o'clock, will you? I agreed. The day rushed along. Entire paragraphs leaped out of my typewriter, needing little if any revision. When I entered the Liberian residency, I found that about 20 people sat in a crescent of chairs. I hastily examined the familiar faces and felt that I had stumbled unluckily into a secret ritual or a dangerous kangaroo court. No one smiled, not even my friends, and the awkward moment could have lasted forever. Joe Williamson's high melodic voice preceded his presence. He said, Sister Maya, we are waiting for you. Come in, come in. Abdul will bring you a drink. Come, you are to sit beside Brother Vus. My eyes followed the general indication of his right hand. Vus sat stiff and sober at the center of the row of chairs. I knew that I was befuddled, thrown, and totally mystified, so I smiled and obeyed Joe's directive, finding an empty seat beside my husband. Joe began. Brothers and sisters, he walked to the center of the floor. You know why we are here. I was handed a drink of scotch. He continued, our sister from across the sea and across the centuries is planning to leave our brother from South Africa. Our sister and her son have returned to Africa. We all know that she has worked very hard and that she feels herself an African. A mumble of agreement followed that statement. He continued, our South African brother wages a fight for all of us. No day passes but that he is on the battlefield. No night comes without Vusumzimake at the gun, threatening the fortress of white oppression. Another rumble of accord lifted and floated in the room. He said, now I, the brother to all of you, have called for palaver. Neither of these young people have family in Egypt, outside this small community. So I have asked you, so that we can examine the points and weigh the matter. Panic was rising in my mind and paralyzing my legs. Joe said, I will ask this side of the room to argue for our sister Maya and this side for our brother Vus. He placed a dining room chair in the middle of the half circle, talking all the while. The group from Maya going right will defend our brother. People left of Vus will support our sister. And please remember, folks, we are the only family they have in this strange land. Joe took his seat and spoke to me. Sister, tell your part. Why did you find our brother impossible as a husband? I said, the man stuffs his thing into any opening he finds. I am faithful and he is not. A few coughs fell from the mouths of my squad, and Vus's troop twitched and cleared their throats. I said, I slave my ass off. Booth spends money as if we were rich. He expects me to be faithful and steady, and he comes home smelling of cheap perfume. I reveled in the rustle of discomfort. They asked me, and I told them. Joe Williamson clapped his hands. All right, Sister Maya has spoken. I call upon Booth's defense. In a snap, queries were directed at me. Have you kept yourself clean? Do you refuse your husband his marital rights? Do you curse and act unbecoming? Do you try to dominate the man? I answered every question with openness and sass. The sooner they rejected me, the sooner this odd ritual would be over. When I finished responding, Joe turned to my squad. Their interrogation of Voos was weak and without heart. There was a hiatus while Joe called for drinks for the crowd. We remained seated, holding fresh icy glasses. Then Joe Williamson began to prance in the clear plot of floor. He says, "It seems to me, brothers and sisters, that our sister Maya is in the right. Her objection is strong. I suggest that this palaver is over and that our brother is the loser." He turned to Voos's supporters. "Do you agree?" When the heads nodded for the first time that night, friendliness and smiles returned to the faces of all my confidants. Joe went to stand in front of Voos and arms reach away. He said, "Bravoos, it is decided that you are in the wrong and Sister Maya is in the right. Do you agree?" Voos lowered his large head in assent. Joe stepped up to me, close enough for me to see clearly the whites of his eyes. "Now, sister, now that the triumph is in your hands, now that the people from many countries agree that you can leave your husband and no guilt will fall on your head, now, in your position of strength, we throw ourselves on your mercy." The group responded with jubilant laughter. "We ask you, from your righteous pinnacle, would you please give the man one more chance?" I looked at Bonte, who instructed me with a nod. I should say yes. I hadn't decided yet where to go, and I had no date when to leave. "Stay 6 months, sister. Give the man 6 months." I said, "I will stay." Chairs scraped the floor. Voos took me into his arms and whispered, "You are a generous woman, my wife." Guy graduated from high school, took a knapsack, and joined Egyptian friends for a trek in the Sahara. My friendship with Kebi and Bonte had become stronger. More women were hired in my office, and some found my presence incongruous and unacceptable. I spoke halting Arabic, smoked cigarettes openly, was not a Muslim, and was an American on top of that. Voos was trying, and so was I, but neither of us was able to infuse vitality into our wilting marriage. He steadily gained weight as I became thinner. Indifference became the mattress we lay on, so that our sexual sharings disintegrated into unsatisfying periods of hasty and uncomfortable rubbings. I had promised to stay for 6 months, and we both felt the time was dragging. After 5 months, I began to think about my future and Guy's placement in an African school. Ghana's university was known to be the best institution of higher learning on the continent. I thought I'd be very lucky to enroll him there. I had no contacts in Ghana, but I did have Joe Williamson as a brother. I went to him. "Joe, I'm leaving." He showed no surprise. I said, "I want to go to West Africa. I want to place Guy in the University of Ghana, and I need a job, and I need your help." He nodded and said he had been expecting my decision and was prepared for it. There was an offer of a job from the Liberian Department of Information based on a white paper on Liberia, which I had written for the United Arab Republic. He got up from his desk and hugged me. "Sister, you will be an asset in Liberia." Voos accepted my departure with undisguised relief. We had worn our marriage threadbare, and it was time to discard it. He would get tickets on United Arab Airlines. He had friends in Ghana we could stay with for a few days, and if I got into trouble, I could always count on him. I could have any of the furniture, which was now paid for, sent on to Liberia. I thanked him for the plane arrangements and refused the furniture. I knew that other women would be in that house before the sheets lost my body's heat. He grinned and hugged me. The day finally arrived to leave Cairo. Guy held my hand on the plane. He leaned near and whispered, "It'll be okay, Mom. Don't cry. I love you, Mom. Lots of people love you." I made no attempt to explain that I was not crying because of a lack of love, or certainly not the loss of Voos's affection. I was mourning all my ancestors. I had never felt that Egypt was really Africa, But now that our route had taken us across the Sahara, I could look down from my window seat and see trees and bushes, rivers and dense forest. It had all begun here, the jumble of poverty-stricken children sleeping in rat-infested tenements or abandoned cars. Here, there, along the banks of that river, someone had been taken, tied with ropes, shackled with chains, forced to march for weeks, carrying the double burden of neck irons and abysmal fear. Every ill I knew at home, each hateful look on a white face, each odious rejection based on skin color, the mockery, the disenfranchisement, the lamentations and loud wailings for a lost world, irreclaimable security, all that long, onerous journey to misery, which had not ended yet, had begun just below my plane. I wept. The airport at Accra sounded like an adult playground and looked like a festival. Single travelers wearing Western suits or dresses, which would be deemed fashionable in New York, were surrounded by hordes of well-wishers, swathed in floral prints or the rich plaid silk of kente cloth. Languages turned the air into clouds of lusty sound. The sight of so many black people stirred my deepest emotions. I had been away from the colors too long. We passed through customs, delighted to have our bags examined by black people. Our taxi driver was black. The dark night seemed friendly to me, and when the cab's lights illuminated a pedestrian, I saw a black face. By the time we reached the address Vuce had given me, a knot in my stomach, which had bunched all my remembered life, had unfurled. I realized I hadn't seen a white face for over an hour. We stopped in front of a rambling white bungalow, which looked eerily fluorescent in the black night. A short, reserved man answered Guy's knock. He welcomed us in and told us that he was Walter Ntia, and after embracing us both, showed us to rooms in the rear of the house. I joined him quickly in the living room to assure him that we didn't plan to stay long. I needed no more than a week to get my son's schooling arranged and to get him a place to stay on campus, and I had to hurry on to Liberia, where I had a job waiting in the Department of Information. Walter said we could stay as long as necessary. He was an economist, working for the Ghanaian government, was divorced, and lived alone. He didn't entertain much, but he asked a few South Africans and black American residents in Ghana to come that evening to greet us. The visitors came together. There was a tall, thin Yoruba man and his Canadian wife, who were introduced as Richard and Ellen, a South African man whose name I could not decipher, and three black Americans. Frank, with his copper-toned skin, smile of spaced teeth, and merry eyes, hugged us as if we were cousins. Vicky Garvin was short and pretty. She shook hands firmly and spoke directly. Alice Wyndham took my heart the moment I saw her. She spoke in a Midwestern accent and laughed as if she had a small cough. Vicky asked if I knew Julian Mayfield and if I knew that he and his wife lived in Accra. Julian, James Baldwin, Rosa Guy, John Killens, and I had spent many nights until dawn arguing, drinking, explaining, and complaining in Paul Marshall's apartment. Alice said I had been invited to Julian's house the next evening. Richard and Ellen added little to the general conversation, save to invite me and Guy to a picnic 2 days later. They said everyone would be there. The man had not charmed me, and his wife was as dry as old bread. I declined their offer, saying we were too tired, but Guy spoke up. He said, "Mother has spoken for herself. I'll be happy to go." Everyone in the room, including me, knew I had been out of line. My son was bigger than anyone else there and nearly grown, and I had acted as if he were still a small boy. In the silence in which I left them, Richard and Ellen and Guy made their arrangements. They would come by early on the morning of the picnic. He didn't need to bring anything. All he had to do was be ready. Frank promised to come and take me and Guy to Julian's house the next day. Julian Mayfield had the looks to flutter a young girl's heart. He was tall, broad, black, witty, handsome, and was married. Aunt Olivia Cordero Mayfield was a small, dark-eyed, beautiful Puerto Rican medical doctor who was as opinionated as a runaway train on a downhill slope. Our reunion was feverish with greetings and news. We retold old stories and exchanged new tales. He said I could go to Liberia with a free mind. He would keep an eye on my son. When I awakened the next morning, Guy's bedroom was empty. Richard and Ellen had gathered him for their picnic, and Walter had left the house. I spent the day examining Guy's clothes, separating the things which could be mended, setting aside the jeans which were only good for dust cloths. I cooked, ate, folded clothes, read the titles in Walter's bookcase until dark. At about 6 o'clock, I began to feel uncomfortable, edgy. I felt as if I had forgotten a commitment or stepped on and crushed some precious thing. The doorbell rang. Alice Wyndham stood on the steps with Frank standing behind her. Alice said, "Hey, Maya, I guess we're first. The rest will be here in a little while." I admitted them into the house and poured glasses of fruit juice, since neither of the two drank alcohol. We sat relaxed in the living room. I asked, "What time do you think Guy will come home?" Alice answered, "We passed them at Winnebah. Richard got drunk at the picnic, so Guy was driving. They should be here in the next few minutes." My mind adapted to her statement. If Guy was driving, everything was all right. Tires gusted on the driveway. Alice said, "Here they are. They've arrived." She opened the door. I stepped out into the hall. Ellen was tousled and covered with blood. When she saw me, she screamed, "Maya, it wasn't our fault. Nobody else was hurt, and anyway, he's still alive." I understood every word and the intent of her hysteric speech and continued walking until I stood close to her red-spotted face. "Where is my son, Ellen? I need to go there now." She said, "He's in Corlebu Hospital, but I swear he was still breathing." When we got into the car, I asked her to stop whimpering. It was neither her life nor her son. We rode to the hospital quickly and in a silence broken only by Ellen's weeping. Corlebu's emergency ward was painfully bright. I started down the corridor and found myself in a white tunnel, interrupted by a single loaded gurney resting against a distant wall. I walked up to the movable table and saw my son, stretched his full length under white sheets. His rich golden skin paled into gray, his eyes closed and his head at an unusual angle. A nurse appeared. She asked, "Who is responsible here?" "I am responsible. I am his mother." She rattled her spiel. "Well, he must have x-rays." The x-ray technician arrived and said, "I'll need someone to hold him and to position him. He's unconscious, but I've got to x-ray his whole body." Alice and I slid Guy's heavy body onto a new table. We shifted him until every inch had been exposed to the baleful eye of the x-ray machine. We pushed him back onto the rolling tray, and I asked the technician to step aside. "How long will he be unconscious?" The man responded, "I can't tell you. I think he's in shock, but he may be in a coma. The pictures will be back tomorrow. Come back in the morning. Maybe there'll be some news." Two nurses wheeled Guy quickly down the hall. I started to follow, but Alice touched my arm. She said, "Let them have him. They'll make him comfortable. That's their business." I went back to Walter's house and made a pot of coffee. I drank cup after cup, cooling the boiling liquid with gin. Alice went home. Walter went to bed. But at dawn, I found a phone directory and called a taxi. In the clear day, the hospital looked like a normal hospital. I was shown to Guy's room. He recognized me, and my spirits soared. He asked, "Hi, Mom, what happened?" His voice was faint, and his skin the color of a hothouse lemon. I told him about the accident, but before I could finish the story, he had drifted back into unconsciousness. I spent the day in Guy's room, watching him slide in and out of consciousness. When I took a taxi to Julian's house, it was because the nurses had pointedly asked me to leave. Aunt Olivia opened the door and I collapsed in her arms. She had heard about the accident, and when the hysteria dissipated, she said that although she was not assigned to Corlebu Hospital, she would make a visit to Guy that evening. I should go and get a good night's sleep. She dropped me at Walter's house. I sat down on my borrowed bed. The next thing I knew, Walter was shaking my shoulder. Sister Maya, sister, Dr. Cordero is on the telephone. I followed him, fumbling my way down the hall. Maya, it's Aunt Olivia. I've had some new x-rays done. They've been developed. I'm at Corlebu now. The accident was more serious than the doctors thought. Guy's neck is broken. The crash, my pale son, his awful clammy skin, my love for him, all rushed into my brain at once. In three places, I have ordered him moved. He's going to be put into body, arm, and leg casts. Are you there, Maya? I was nowhere. Certainly nowhere I'd ever been before. I said, yes, of course. She explained that she had contacts at the military hospital, and when the plaster hardened, he would be taken there. He was quite tense, so it was better that I held off my visit until he calmed down. I said, I'm on my way. She meant well, but she didn't know my son. She didn't know the cocky boy who had lived with the certainty of white insolence and the unsureness of moving from school to school, coast to coast, and was made to find his way through another continent and new cultures, a person whose only certitude lay in the knowledge that his mom, effective or not, was never too far away. I said, I'm on my way. I waited in the halls and yard and canteens of the hospital while the plaster hardened, then joined my son in the ambulance for his transfer. The still damp cast emitted a sour odor, but my sedated son looked like a pale yellow angel in a long white gown. Guy would be in the hospital for 1 month, and then he'd have to recover at home for 3 months. I moved into the YWCA and wrote to Joe and Bonte Williamson. Going to Liberia had to be canceled. I would find a job and stay in Ghana. Julian suggested that I meet Efua Sutherland, poet, playwright, and head of Ghana's theater. She received me cordially. She knew of the accident. She took my hands and looked in my eyes and said, "Sister, sister, you need to weep." When she said that, I realized I had not cried since the accident. She said, "You need to weep, sister. And you need a sister to watch you weep. You may now weep." When I dried my eyes hours later and returned to some composure, I explained my need for work and I listed my credentials. She arranged for me to meet Professor J.H. Nketiah, ethnomusicologist and head of the Institute of African Studies. She telephoned me before the week was out to tell me I had a job at the University of Ghana as administrative assistant. I tried to say thank you, to tell her how much I appreciated her kindness, but she continued, "An instructor we know is on leave for 6 months. We have arranged for you to have his house." I told her I was grateful, and her cool voice brushed in my ear. She said, "Sister, I am a mother too," and she hung up. When I picked up Guy from the hospital, he reminded me of a big tree about to fall. He had grown another inch and put on a few pounds from inactivity. The cast, which covered his head and spread out over his shoulders like a monk's cowl, was gray with dirt, but he had to wear it another 3 months. We celebrated his homecoming with roast chicken and dressing, our favorite food. He was in high spirits. He had lived. Aunt Olivia said he was mending well. He had made a few friends in the hospital, and soon he would be enrolled in the university. The next day, I took his diploma and report cards to the registrar's office and was told bluntly that my son could not enter the university. He was not qualified. the University of Ghana had been modeled on the British system. Students had to have completed the sixth form, or as Americans call it, junior college. I was dismissed peremptorily. That was unacceptable. Guy had been through as much as I could handle. Connor Cruz O'Brien was the vice chancellor of the university, and Nana Kuvanankesia IV, a paramount chief, was former vice chancellor. I made an appointment to see Dr. O'Brien, and F.Y. Sutherland introduced me to the Nana. I pleaded and talked, moaned and whined, and I wasn't asking for a scholarship or any financial aid. I would pay tuition, and I would buy his books. After weeks of haunting the offices, collaring the men in halls, catching up with them on the campus paths, I was finally told that they had decided it was not fair to penalize students coming from American schools. They had arranged a three-part test. Guy would be expected to take the examination on Monday at 9 o'clock. I took Guy the news, and since I hadn't told him of the trouble, he took it casually. Okay, Mom, I'll be ready. Monday morning, my desk felt like sponge, and the papers on it were unintelligible. I looked at my watch every 5 minutes. At last, Guy came loping across the campus, his cast helmet looking almost white under the noonday sun. He entered my tiny office, taking up its spare room. He said, "Finished." I asked, "How did you do?" "Great. I won't get the results for a couple of days. Mom, do you know that Connor Cruz O'Brien is the same man who headed the United Nations Congo project?" I knew. Well, one of my questions was, "What role has the European in African development?" He chuckled with pleasure. He said, "Well, I'll tell you, I ate Dr. O'Brien up in little pieces. I had read his book, To Katanga and Back, in Cairo." He leaned over and kissed my cheek. He said, "I'm going to meet some guys in the junior common room." Speechless, I watched him bound away. I had tommed, mewed, and begged to get him registered. And in an attempt to show how manly he was, the smart ass had bungled everything. After an hour, when I could walk without my knees wobbling and speak without yelling, I crossed the campus and found Dr. O'Brien in the senior common room. I spoke out of a mealy mouth. I said, "Dr. O'Brien, Guy told me how he answered one of those questions. You haven't had a chance to see his examination yet." He said, "Oh, but I have, Miss Angelo. His answers are fine. His registration papers will be sent to your office. We want minds like that in the university." I grinned again and backed away. Sooner or later, I was going to have to admit that I didn't understand black men or black boys, and certainly not white men. Guy was moving into Mensa Sarba Hall. For the first time in his life, he was going to live alone, away from my persistent commands. My reaction was in direct contrast with his excitement. I was going to be alone also, for the first time. He dragged the old trunk toward the door, but I stopped him. I said, "Don't lift heavy things like that. You could hurt yourself. I want you to be careful. Remember your neck." He put the trunk down and turned. "Mom, I know I'm your only child and you love me. But there's something for you to remember, too. It is my neck, and it's my life, and I will live it whole or not at all." He pulled me to him and wrapped his arms around me. "I love you, Mom. Maybe now you'll have a chance to grow up." A car horn honked outside. Guy opened the door and called, "Come on in, I'm ready." Two Ghanaian young men leaped onto the porch shouting and blustering into the room. When they saw me, they composed themselves. I offered them a drink, a beer, some food. I wanted to delay the departure. All refused. They had to return the car to their uncle, and Guy had to begin his new life. They shared Guy's possessions, trundling the boxes, grips, and the trunk into a new Mercedes-Benz. Guy gave me one more squeeze. Then they piled into the car and drove away. I closed the door and held my breath, waiting for the wave of emotion to surge over me, to knock me down, to take my breath away. Nothing happened. I didn't feel bereft or desolate. I didn't feel lonely or abandoned. I sat down, still waiting, and the first thought that came to me, perfectly formed and promising, was, at last I'll be able to eat the whole breast of a chicken by myself.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.